Okay, we're back, and it is March 3rd, 2015. Here we go.
Well, I take it that there was a mutiny among the troops regarding my tendency to recapitulate the previous session at the beginning of the present session, and this was wasting a lot of time in some people's opinion. I do reserve the right to occasionally fill in something that I may have forgotten the last time, which is, in my opinion, worth preserving. And I am going to take a minute or two to remember something that I did not mention before.
Right.
And that is that I was feeling so depressed by my failure to be able to hold on to any kind of position with the surveillance of the Medi-Cal program. And my being forced to accept a really dumb place in something called the Air Sanitation Bureau. I was seriously considering dropping out altogether and doing some writing, and I had in mind a novel, an absurdist novel, kind of inspired by the example of Catch-22. I was going to call it The Memorandum Jungle. But then a cooler head prevailed, namely my own. And I had to face the fact that I was now responsible for child support of five children since, among other things, my second marriage had also failed. So I had to keep working. And I don't know what I would have done if it hadn't dropped in my lap totally unexpectedly that a position was available in the community studies of pesticides. And I'll say a few words about that, since it was part of the bureaucratic jungle. This was funded entirely by the Environmental Protection Agency, part of the federal government in Washington, D.C., quite different from most of the other functions of the State Health Department, which were usually totally dependent upon appropriations by the state legislature. In the case of the community studies of pesticides, we had to apply every year for funding from Washington. And at the time that I was interested in it, it functioned under the overall umbrella of the Bureau of Occupational Health, which was headed by.
He tried.
He went into high speed just to foil me.
Just to show you. Ah, no.
We tried it.
The chief of the Bureau of Occupational Health was a doctor named Tom Milby. And he apparently knew or cared something about pesticides because he had done some research on the women who had worked for a major manufacturer of pesticides Might have been Monsanto, I'm not sure. And he studied whether when these women had children, with the residues of their exposure to the pesticide, particularly he was interested in DDT. And the question was whether some residues were transmitted through their mother's milk to their children. He made something of a reputation for that research, I believe. And he, in fact, at the time that this vacancy in the pesticide studies unit was being discussed, he interviewed me before he passed me on down the line to the head of the pesticide unit itself. And Milby warned me in advance that I would have to go through an oral exam to be held down in Southern California, and that one of the members of the panel was probably going to be a guy, I think, from USC, who was pro-pesticides, and I should be prepared for a question that might not be altogether a cream puff. The head of the pesticide studies unit was a guy, I guess, with a PhD in some field, but I'm not sure which one it was. His name was Dudley Miller, and I was interviewed by him, and he seemed very agreeable and amiable and simpatico and all kinds of good things, so I had a good feeling about that. And there was another professional person in the staff. I guess his position was, I don't remember the technical term for the position, but his pay grade was the same as mine, as associate public health analyst. And there was a secretary for the unit. Well, I went down to LA for the oral interview. And in fact, the guy did ask me after some preliminaries, what did I think of Rachel Carson? Rachel Carson had written a book called Silent Spring, which was a piece of special pleading, really, that the use of DDT was having an extremely deleterious effect upon certain bird populations, those which lived on fish principally, because the fish were becoming affected by the runoff of DDT, which was very long-lived pesticide. It built up in the food chain. And these seabirds were laying eggs that had very soft shells. And they broke very frequently before hatching, and these bird populations were dwindling at an alarming rate, to such an extent that, as the title of Carson's book suggests, there were parts of the country in which the songbirds were not being heard as they used to be. Well, I tried to box the question without answering it very directly as to whether I liked it or not. I said something to the effect that it was very effective in its way. And the guy let the subject drop. And so I passed that exam. It was it was pretty much a sham. They all knew that I was wanted by Milby, and they didn't want to antagonize Milby by turning down anything that he wanted. And so I reported for work, I guess in September of 68, I guess. And the first assignment that I was given by Dudley Miller, as I think he put it in the form of a question, really, he said, there's going to be a trial to be held in Bakersfield, in which the health department is going to want the right to have the manufacturers of agricultural chemicals report what they have sold, where and for what purposes, and in what quantities. And the manufacturers are going to take the position that these are trade secrets, and they don't have to report if they don't want to, and they didn't want to. The hidden agenda was that they didn't regard the health department as a friendly department. They thought that the supervision of the use of agricultural chemicals should be with the State Department of Agriculture, which of course was legally responsible for protecting and advancing the interests of the industry of agriculture, whereas the purpose of the health department was to preserve and protect and enhance the health of the public at large. Well, I accepted this assignment with pleasure. So I went down there and sat in for a couple of days, and I believe that after the judge took it under submission, it ended with the health department winning, and the judge refused to issue an injunction prohibiting them from receiving this information. So I came back and I wrote a report on what I had seen and heard. And because it was for a very limited audience, that namely Dr. Dudley Miller himself, I didn't hesitate to write it in a non-bureaucratic way, with adjectives and adverbs and whatever I might add to add spice to the subject rather than the usual bureaucraties. And Dudley Miller liked it a lot. He told me that it was a noble piece of writing. First person that had ever said anything about any of my writing. So that meant a good deal to me. I would have liked nothing more than to have continued working under Dudley Miller, but it seems that he was on the verge of retiring. And within a matter of a month or two, he did, and was replaced by a guy named Bill, and I have blanked out on his last name. The psychologist might call it motivational forgetting. I didn't have much respect for him. He was a PhD in chemistry. I don't have any idea how he got his PhD, but it didn't have anything to do with pesticides. So I began sending out ideas for research subjects that I felt would fit within the purview of the Community Study of Pesticides unit. And up to this point, their studies had almost all been on the people with possible pesticide exposure during the manufacture of these compounds. And to some extent, the application of these materials in the fields by crop dusting planes or ground rigs. But the unit had never, up to that point, studied the effects of these chemicals on field workers. And that, of course, was my big interest. So I began sending out possible ideas for research projects, beginning with a survey. So I was an old hand at designing questionnaires and running them by a sample of one population or another. So it occurred to me that I would ask people knowledgeable about the field of the kinds of symptoms that people might exhibit who had been exposed to agricultural chemicals on the job, on the job harvesting the crops. And I proposed that a questionnaire be designed which would list 10 or 12 or whatever number of these symptoms, mingled with a few that were not related, just so people wouldn't get an idea that this was biased. And that the questionnaire be administered to a representative group of farm workers and a control group of those who had never worked in agriculture. So I got the advice of Miller and Milby and anybody else in the health department that might have ideas on this subject. And was given carte blanche to go down into Tulare County, which was selected because they had something going on. We were approaching the late fall and winter season, and in some parts of the state, like the Salinas Valley, there wouldn't be any agricultural harvest going on at that time of year. But in Tulare County, there was something going on year-round. In the middle of the winter, the navel orange harvest is at its peak. So that's why I selected that area as the study site. And also, just it happens that my old friend Cesar Chavez was in the midst of organizing grape workers and mounting a boycott of grapes, not only in the area, but in the country, and in fact overseas as well. And one of the weapons that he was using in the boycott was to try to tell people that they're under existing conditions, that is, growers who were not organized by the union, were using these pesticides on grapes without supervision, and Chavez was very interested in the whole subject of pesticide control. So I talked to him about it and said...
Can I interrupt here?
Yes.
What was the extent of your personal contact with Cesar Chavez? When did you meet him? Was he actually your personal friend at that point, or...?
Oh, I had known him way back when I... was starting as research director for AWOC. That was in July of 1959, and I must have met him that fall. And we kept in touch one way or the other for all of the intervening years. It's not that we saw each other regularly at all. But our paths would cross. When the strike first began, the great grape strike began in September of 1965. And I used to go on car caravans. This was one of the functions of the organization that I started called Citizens for Farm Labor. We would take car caravans of supplies of beans and rice and so forth, because they had mass meetings every weekend at which Chavez and the other leaders of the strike, including there was always at this point, at the beginning of the strike, there were representatives of the Filipinos very actively involved also. So there would be a mass meeting at which the workers themselves would hear progress reports. And the general public was welcome to sit in. And so those of us who went down with supplies in these caravans would mingle in and take part, at least listening to these reports. And I would usually sit near the back of the hall because I thought that the farm workers themselves should be principal actors always. But Chavez was gifted at being able to remember names and faces. And it seems that every time I went down, no matter where I sat in this auditorium, he would spot me and remember me and walk down the aisle and greet me. And this just made me feel great. So that's why I would say I've considered him a friend. Now, that I was in this field of pesticide studies, he said that if he had known I was looking for a job, that I could have worked for him. He was being semi-facetious, because at that time all of his co-workers were paid $5 a week for spending money and room and board. And that would have, I would have been working for that if I had worked for Chavez. But he knew I had dependents and I couldn't possibly do so. But he talked about that possibility. But the reason I wanted to talk to him on this occasion was that I needed interviewers. And he suggested two or three people that he knew were highly responsible, and they were farm workers themselves, probably working in the oranges at that time of year. But he thought that what the health department would be able to pay them would be equal to what they were able to make by picking oranges. So he gave me their names and addresses and phone numbers, and I interviewed them, and they were, in fact, very highly responsible people, all of them Spanish-speaking, and were willing to work for the health department, because they were also interested in the subject matter. Now, I had to instruct them, as I had my interviewer in the Bracero study years previously, that this should be presented as being of general public health interest, with not any axe to grind. I did not want them to have the feeling that we were gonna try to eliminate agricultural pesticides or anything of that sort. So we got several hundred results, and found that for most of the symptoms that were likely to be associated with exposure to parathion and the other or getting phosphates. There did seem to be a statistically significant difference between the frequency that people said they had experienced these things within the study period. But there were a number of holes in the methodology. And eventually, after we had several hundred returns, I was convinced that we should turn to other ways of looking at the effects of pesticides on field workers. A couple of years later, I learned that almost exactly this same methodology had in fact been used by a team of sociologists from UC Davis. And they, of course, did not give me any credit, but I didn't care. As they say, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So, another one of my ideas had to do with a line of argumentation that manufacturers of pesticides used that if field workers suffered from exposure, it was to a large extent their own fault for not protecting themselves adequately by what they wore. And if one followed up this line of argumentation at all, they were happy enough to write back a list of things that field workers should wear to protect themselves. They didn't ever indicate whether these things should be provided by their employers or whether they should pay for them out of pocket. But they would include things like what they call fingerless gloves. A glove in which, in effect, the fingers were exposed so that one could grasp whatever crop might be involved. But the palm of the hand, according to these manufacturers, was particularly vulnerable to dermal exposure. The thumb and fingers were better protected by pads. The palm was more wide open. So that was one thing that farm workers should protect themselves with. And I remember that another area that was emphasized was the forehead. That was supposed to be a wide open avenue in which the residues could leach into the bloodstream and have adverse effects. And then, of course, one should wear proper clothing to protect the body. I don't think that they ever went so far as to recommend wearing anything like rain clothes, raincoats or rubberized material of any kind, because in warm weather that would have been unthinkable for a field worker. But field workers were supposed to wear reasonably thick shirting and pants materials. So I conceived the idea of testing out this line of argument by figuring out exactly how much was penetrating the clothing to the skin. And I guess what I did was have patches of aluminum foil or some such substance taped to arms and legs and torso. And retrieved after a day's work, and forwarded to the pesticide laboratory, which was maintained in the main building of the State Health Department. Where there was a guy on duty full time to examine specimens with a spectroscope to see how much of what kinds of pesticides penetrated the clothing that was worn. This lab existed for purposes other than our pesticide studies unit. It was available for local health departments around the state, I guess, if there were suspected pesticide poisonings by accidents, or I suppose in some cases by suspected foul play. Here was a good example of the kind of thing that I was going to put into my novel. The guy who ran, in fact, he was a one-man operation. The fellow at the pesticide laboratory would put these samples into a freezer to be examined at his leisure. And he did love his leisure. Every time that I ever visited that lab, I always found him reading the Wall Street Journal and he did not take his work seriously. Let's just put it that way. He lacked all passion for safeguarding the public health. Jim was his name. I have perhaps deliberately forgotten his last name. Well, another one of the tasks which both my associate Don Mengel was the fellow with the same job title I had, whatever that was. And whenever there was a major pesticide poisoning from the field, one or the other of us would usually go out and try to get a complete history of what had happened and why. I should mention that at just about this point in history, and I think it was roughly the time that I started working with the Pesticide Studies Unit, the Health Department, I think under the leadership of Dr. Lester Breslow, whom I have mentioned on a number of occasions, as being a real pioneer in the field of public health, as long ago as the first year that I was ever there in 1952. At that point, he was already trying to get the health department and the public at large concerned about the effects of smoking cigarettes. This was before anybody else was talking about it. So he was a pioneer, as I say. I believe that he used his influence, which was considerable, to get the state to make pesticide poisoning to be a reportable condition by physicians in the public, the private practice of medicine. Just as surely as if they got a case of measles or mumps or some other communicable disease. He wanted to add pesticide poisoning, even if it were only suspected pesticide poisoning, to be reportable. That is to say, reported on a standardized form to the state health department. And there are certain cases in which a practicing physician in a rural area should be able to spot something that was probably caused by exposure to these compounds that are called organic phosphates, and they include things like parathion and many others that have similar names, glutathione and ethion and so forth, highly toxic. So, reports would come in, and in some cases, they were fully self-contained. They might, for example, indicate that after laboratory analysis, it was found that the cause was something else, and so no further investigation was needed. But in other cases, the reports were quite skimpy. And so either Don Mengel or I would go out and get and fill in the missing information. There was never any lack of things to do.
How do you spell mangle?
Pardon me?
How do you spell mangle? Mangle?
What about
spelling?
M-O-M-E-N-G-E-L, I guess. My reading, I came across an article about a group in England which had worked on a technique to ascertain the effects of organic phosphates by what was called electromyography. Which consisted of stimulating a nerve, the ulnar nerve, by a small electric shock, which would result in a reflex action by the muscles of the forearm, kind of like analogous to the effect of a doctor using a little rubber mallet to press the nerve at a knee joint, which in a healthy person results in a involuntary reflex. And the idea was that you can get a picture of the spike resulting from this reaction to the stimulus. A little bit like print out from an electrocardiogram, except in this case it was limited to a series, trying to remember some of the details. I think it went boom, 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 a series of four stimuli with a picture of each, and in a normal, healthy individual, the spikes should be identical. But if a person had a somewhat impaired neuromuscular system, there would be a decline in the volume of each responding reflex. So I looked around to try to find somebody who might be able to duplicate the general outline of the apparatus required based upon the description in this article, which was pretty fragmentary actually. Well, I finally found an outfit in Alameda that said they would take a crack at it. Various safeguards built in so that nobody would be electrocuted. And they succeeded in getting something serviceable. And we tried it out on ourselves. And it wasn't exactly pleasurable, but as long as a person were told in advance what to expect, we thought we might be able to get some data. Once again, comparing results from people that we knew had been exposed, particularly in the harvest of oranges, because you're working in among the leaves full time, and it's if those leaves had any pesticide residues on them, you were bound to inhale some stuff and also to get it on your skin and so forth and so on. And then we could compare those results with those for people who had not been exposed. Well, once again, I went down to Tulare County to look for subjects, and this time it didn't require any interviewers. This time I was looking for people who were willing to be exposed if they weren't already, and who were also willing to take part in this experiment involving small electric jolts. And I was only able to find one to begin with, and that was Stephen Anderson. This was in the summer, and he was out here from back east where he was living at that time. I think he was probably, well, I don't know, we could figure it out. He might have been starting Harvard already by this time. In any case, we got him a job picking oranges. And at the end of the day, hooked him up with his apparatus and got an electromyograph. And we might have kept this up for a couple of days. But we had great difficulty finding other people to take part.
Was he exposed to pesticides?
Oh, he couldn't have failed to be. The results were indeterminate. Possibly because the equipment wasn't all that great. say that it was really practically impossible to get a large cohort. So this had to be written off as an interesting beginning, which required further work. And once again, we didn't have the time or expertise to carry it on to a really convincing conclusion. The gold standard in assessing the effects of organic phosphates is taking blood samples and studying those samples for an enzyme called cholinesterase, which is crucial in the transmission of neurological impulses. Exposure to organic phosphates inhibits cholinesterase activity. And it is a really reliable marker. Now, I may have mentioned the name Wendy Gopal in some of my previous episodes. She and I had worked together very closely in the formation of Citizens for Farm Labor, editing our magazine and so forth. When the great strike in 1965 broke out, she left Berkeley, moved to Delano, and became kind of a personal secretary to Chavez. But in the course of time, she met a young doctor who was setting up a clinic to be called Salud, which means health, intended primarily for agricultural workers. So she left the farm worker strike in order to work full time for the formation and growth of this clinic. In the course of time, she and this young doctor, whose name was Brooks, David Brooks, they got married and didn't live happily ever after, but they made quite the success of that clinic. So I went to Wendy and said, how about our drawing off a small portion of the blood samples that you take for other purposes and look at those subsamples for a cholinesterase level. And she thought that was a capital idea. In order to round out the research design, it was necessary to have people who had given these blood samples go into some detail about the activities that they had carried out in the 30 days or so prior to having that test taken, and then dividing up into two groups, those who had done farm work and those who hadn't, and those who had done farm work needed to be further subdivided as to how much work they had done and what crops and so forth and so on. It was pretty complex. But it was the best thing going. And it kept on going as long as I was with the pesticide studies unit. It's almost time to call it a day, and I'm not going to be able to finish up my gig with pesticide studies until next time. A really interesting part of the story is yet to come.
Okay. So what were the so these organic phosphates interfered with neuromuscular activity? What other kinds of symptoms would people have? And were there, did you look at long-term things like cancer rates or?
Pesticides can be divided roughly into two large groups. The organic phosphates are comparatively short-lived. Another group is called chlorinated hydrocarbons, and that group includes the DDTs and other long-lasting pesticides, and it has effects largely on the reproductive system rather than the neuromuscular system.
What pests were these things targeted at? Like in oranges, for example?
What was that question again?
What pests did these target?
Insects.
And they...
Interestingly enough, the principal target in oranges is called a thrip. And its only damage is cosmetic. It leaves a little scar around the stem. And sometimes though they douse the trees heavily with parathion at the time of year that the thrips are likely to emerge from wherever they began life. In the making their exit, they leave this scar. And the inside of the orange is absolutely unaffected. So this this particular use of parathion is simply because the housewives of America want flawless fruit and vegetables. And they consider this small scar to be as serious as if there were a worm inside the orange, which there never was and never will be. But you can't argue with the taste of American consumers.
So what were the long-term effects on humans of organic phosphates?
The long-term effects of organic phosphates were probably minimal, maybe nil. It's the short-term effects that one has to worry about. And they would include dizziness and sweating.
Did it cause accidents among the workers? I mean, if you're up on a 20-foot ladder and you get dizzy, would people fall?
I suppose that is possible. Somewhere in my souvenirs, I have illustrations of all of these projects, including copies of that questionnaire, including examples of the electromyography work that I got from studying Steven, and copies of my field reports on particularly dramatic poisoning cases in which I probably wrote in a rather purple style, knowing myself as I do. But I would have to go through all of the boxes that are stored at the rear of the property at 1243 8 Ashby Avenue. And I just haven't had time. Oh, dear.
that it? Any questions, Gene?
Where is it? Wendy Gopal?
The question was something about Wendy Gopal.
Well, how do you spell her last name?
Ah, G-O-E-P-E-L.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.